Well, sign of the times, we're not going to see packed parking lots at stadiums when fans are going to the venues, but we are seeing Dodger Stadium and Angel Stadium and Anaheim, etc., with rental cars. There's nobody using the rental car fleet, so they got to put them somewhere. So Santa Anita chipping in as well. Odd times indeed, and just another image to reflect that. Hi, everyone. It is Lunch Talk Live. Mike Tirico, glad you are with us on a Thursday before Memorial Day weekend as everything starts to slowly inch back to maybe testing a little foot in the water of what will be normal for the new normal out there. More sports going on. We're going to hit that here coming up in just a moment. The guest list is pretty good today. I should mention the podcast if you miss any of the show, an NBC Sports YouTube channel. David Shaw, the coach of Stanford, football coach, will join us. NCAA weighing in with some new information and guidance for teams yesterday. We'll ask the head coach at Stanford for 9 years about all of that. Tom Colicchio is going to join us, one of the best chefs you can ever find out there. And Bravo's Top Chef tonight not only features Tom, but I'm a part of it. And I don't cook. Anybody who knows me knows I don't cook, but we'll have Tom to visit for a few minutes. John Carlson, the potential Norris Trophy winner, the defenseman for the Washington Capitals, and Lee Diffie, our Indy 500 voice, will join us as we look ahead to this weekend, what we have planned in the stead of the Indy 500. But first, let's get to last night. And again, nice to have highlights to share with everyone. From the NASCAR race last night, rain shortened, Denny Hamlin gets the win at Darlington as the rain comes before the last 20 laps or so could be run. The evening highlighted at the end with the Denny Hamlin happy face. So there's one way to always be cheery, no matter your mood. Just have the perfect mask with the happy face. Dale Jarrett, we'd have to get the new look beard for you to go with that. The Hall of Famer joins us now. I like the look, and I like Hamlin's mask. That's a pretty good way to celebrate and have a smiling face at the end of the deal.
Yeah, certainly his mask is much better than my beard. I just attribute this to being old and lazy during this time. So a lot easier to do that. But what a great race we saw at Darlington last night.
Yes, as a guy who's been around that track so many times, and you watch Sunday and then you watch Wednesday, what was the difference last night compared to Sunday?
Yeah, I think that a couple of things. First and foremost was I love the idea that NASCAR came up with that they were going to invert the top 20 finishers for their starting positions in last night's race. That made for some people that we didn't see up front in the race on Sunday. Clint Bowyer did an outstanding job in winning the first two stages. You saw Kyle Busch and Kevin Harvick and a number of others have to work really, really hard to work themselves up to the front. Now, they eventually did that. Chase Elliott, another that was around there all day, he had a good run on Sunday too. But just the difference in the racetrack, and I think Kevin Harvick alluded to this, that his car just didn't do the things at night when you've got a little more grip on that racetrack than what they saw during the day. So I just hate we didn't get to see those last 20 laps, the incident between Kyle Busch and Chase Elliott there. Hard racing, but unfortunate for Chase because I really think that he had a good shot at going up and challenging Denny for the win.
So there you see the points earned from last night with Hamlin with the victory. And you mentioned the incident at the end with Chase Elliott and Kyle Busch. It kind of got a lot of folks' attention. Let's go back and hear from Kyle Busch involved in it as he spoke with Fox after the race about this incident that happened just before the red flag and the rain came. Here's what he had to tell the Fox reporter.
Do you believe that Gustafson and their side believe exactly what happened?
Go ask them.
Well, you had the conversation with them. How did he leave it?
They're upset. They're mad. I'm not just going to fix it, and we're going to have go ice cream tomorrow, yep. You know? So, obviously, they're going to have to dwell on it, and the repercussions of it, I'm sure I'm going to have later on down the road.
Well, Dale Jarrett, there was the Chase Elliott, your number one salute, as he waited for Kyle to come by there. It just felt for just a brief moment like, hey, we're back to old-time feelings and emotions. Let me get to that in a second. There's the view there. Give me your view of the incident and what happened there with Kyle.
Well, yeah, before Kyle got to that part in his interview, he said, look, I made a mistake as a race driver. And you have to understand that these are the best in the world at driving stock cars, but they do make mistakes and things are going to happen. You don't expect that to happen on a straightaway, but when you're going 170, 75 miles an hour on the straightaway at the end of the race, Kyle Busch got himself in a position to where Chase Elliott had made a great move up in 3 and 4, got to his outside, but he, just as he was trying to move in line, he was also having to look to see how quickly Kevin Harvick was coming behind him. Was that hole going to close up? And just that split second was enough for him to misjudge just a little bit and clip the left rear. There was nothing intentional about that. And I know if you're a Chase Elliott fan, you think that Kyle Busch wrecked him intentionally, and I'm not going to try to talk you out of that. But this was racing, hard racing, and one driver made a mistake. And unfortunately, you know, none of us that ever done this are perfect. We've all been in that situation and something happened. Now, will Chase Elliott make things difficult for Kyle Busch in races to come throughout this season? I think he probably will. Don't know that he's just going to go wreck him by any means, but there's a lot of things you can do as a driver. So we haven't seen or heard the end of this. This is going to go on for the entire year, but it kind of shows that NASCAR racing and the competitors are back in the spirit. Sure.
Oh, man, that answer gave me so many questions. First of all, I'll clear up one thing. Gustafson, who you heard mentioned, is the crew chief for Chase Elliott and has a history with Kyle Busch. He and Kyle have a great relationship from the years, so that's why they were in a more civil, perhaps, conversation, although the language was a bit salty. Can you just share, now that you're out of the car, can you just share one of those things that a driver might do to make things difficult, as you said, as the season goes on?
Yeah, and we'll just go to the race this coming Sunday at Charlotte Motor Speedway for the Coca-Cola 600. If they're around each other, and they're going to be, because both of them are going to be racing up front on a regular basis. As a driver, you get on this bumper. If you're trying to make a pass, you might spend an extra lap or two just worrying him, getting right up on his bumper without ever touching him, and make his car loose. You might get him out of shape. Or if he's trying to pass you, you use all the racetrack. You make him work extremely hard. If you're side by side and you run up on another car, a slow car, you block him in behind there. Just make life miserable as you possibly can. And you can do a lot of that more from behind, on their bumper, getting them loose, and just make it, just being aggravating, kind of like a kid that wants to aggravate another kid on the playground. That's kind of what you do. And we'll see Chase Elliott do these things. And don't think it'll escalate more than that, but you never know. You get in a tight situation, a lot can happen with that. And I'll guarantee you that just as we saw with Chase Elliott with Denny Hamlin a couple of years ago after their run in at Martinsville, and then they went to Phoenix, and Chase just moved him up the racetrack a little bit, and Denny got into the wall. So those kind of things are going to happen. Expect them to race each other extremely hard, especially in the case of Chase Elliott.
Now, you're one of the nicest guys I've met. You're one of the nicest guys in the sport over the years. And that's happened to you. So you've had to play some of those retribution games, if you will. Is there ever a satisfaction? Do you feel like you got the guy back if you can kind of bury him for a couple of laps along the way when it matters?
Yeah, you know, I think the best thing that I ever felt from doing something with another driver, it wasn't ever hitting them. It was just getting them loose enough just to where their car, it was uncomfortable for them. And they had to chase their car up out of the groove. And not only was I able to make the pass on them, but maybe they lost 2, 3, 4 more spots. And then that's a little bit of gratification and satisfaction for me as a driver.
So I was watching the race. I watched the last maybe hour or so last night, hour and a half. And my son, who is not necessarily a NASCAR fan, hops in and he's watching. He's watching what's going on. Then he watches the little back and forth in the pits after the race is called. And he's like, oh, it looked like that was going to get intense. And I said, in a different time, when we weren't all in this feel-good mood, or let's just be thankful of what we have, that may have gotten a little bit saltier. Do you feel that has some validity to it?
Oh, 100%. That could have escalated in a hurry in a different time. You go back to last year. That would have turned into something between the crews getting involved. And even though you mentioned Alan Gustafson and Kyle Busch are good friends, I believe maybe Alan was the crew chief in Kyle's first win in the Cup Series. And they've remained good friends. But he was not happy because he knew that his driver, Chase Elliott, really had this race in hand. He had the best tires and he had the best car at that time and was probably going to dispose of Denny Hamlin there. But yes, this could have got, Chase would have got there. He would have been involved in that. So things could have got a little bit ugly. But, you know, we expect that. We expect that from competitors in the NASCAR side of it. Not that I'm advocating fighting, but going and standing your ground, hey, there's nothing wrong with that. So we'll get back to that time Hopefully all sports are going to come back. We need sports. We need competition. We need to see competitors and athletes doing extraordinary things. And, you know, it makes us feel good to see these people do these things. And we'll have some scuffling going on, hopefully, before this year is over.
Dale, I got to tell you, I'm kind of conflicted here because I just had the news on this morning, and you're looking at all the impact of COVID-19 and the number of deaths are on the side of the screen. Yet we're sitting here actually having a real sports conversation, and it feels good. And you have that internal guilt of feeling good about what's going on. But we all do need some respite and some balance. What about the opportunity for your sport? I mean, you saw Sunday, you saw Wednesday, you're getting back on track here, continuing trying to get the Xfinity race in today, back to Charlotte in a couple of days. How do you think NASCAR is handling this opportunity one week in?
Yeah, you know, we've had a lot of people talk about why NASCAR, why are they able to come back? And I think if you look at the sport, and even though it might be a sport that a lot of people haven't followed throughout the years, but maybe now are watching because it is something live, you know, the competitors aren't. And we saw even in a situation like last night, they're not upright against each other. So NASCAR's done a tremendous job in keeping everyone separated there, doing a really, really good job. And I think that the sport has been able to showcase itself a little bit here and will continue to be able to do that, putting on races and the competitors doing a great job there and hopefully gaining a few more fans throughout. I think golf's a lot the same way. We're going to see Tiger and Phil go at it with Tom and Peyton Manning on Sunday. So I think they can do those things too. But in a race car, even though you'd love to see those stands filled up with fans there, you don't hear them. Seldom do you even see them. Sometimes you might catch a glimpse, you know, if a pass is being made of the fans standing and cheering. But you don't have that effect that you have in other sports. We want the fans there, and we want them to get back to that point. But right now, we can sit in front of our TVs and watch this and let these guys entertain us.
And lastly, as we wrap up, what's Charlotte going to be like as you head to the Charlotte Motor Speedway for what traditionally is the longest race and also usually with the weather around Memorial Day weekend, yeah, one of the most grueling races for the drivers who are just coming off two cup races for the first time in 10 weeks?
Yeah, Darlington was a tough place for a different reason, but now we're talking about a track a little bigger with higher speeds yet. We're going to really see. We've heard a lot of these drivers talk about their conditioning and how they really put more effort in it. Well, they better, because coming up is 600 miles, and when you're in the best shape of your life, that is hard to do. And you transition, you start in daylight, the racetrack changes because you get into the darkness. Yeah. That racetrack changes tremendously. And also, you pick up and start running your fastest laps of the day of these 600 miles late in the race because the track is cooled down so much. So that takes a physical toll on you, too. We're going to see some great racing. I'm really excited to watch that again. But I also want to know that we know a lot of people out there are struggling. We're thinking about you, praying for you. And for those families that have been affected by this, we certainly have you in our prayers, and we'll keep you there.
Well said. Great perspective. Man's won 3 Daytona 500s and one of 3 father-son combos in the Hall of Fame with his dad, Ned. Dale Jarrett. Dale, great to catch up with you. I like the beard, man. I look forward to seeing you down the road. Stay well.
Thanks a lot, Mike. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
All right. Yeah, you too, Dale. When we come back, David Shaw, the head football coach at Stanford, will join us as the NCAA gave some new parameters for coaches like David to figure out when they can start dealing with their teams again. Be right back. Well, look forward to next week on NBCSN in prime time. It will be all week athletes who hosted Saturday Night Live in some of their episodes and skits. Michael Jordan starts it on Memorial Day night at 8 Eastern. After that, LeBron James and Charles Barkley. So three of the basketball best play funny men. Saturday Night Live on NBCSN. That's coming up all next week starting Monday. David Shaw, year 9 as the Stanford head football coach, and he joins us now. I wonder, David, could you handle hosting Saturday Night Live? The writers are great. Can you deliver some funny lines?
As my players would say, that's not really my bag. I know where my lane is, and I stay in it.
Well, it's been a darn good lane you found. As one of the best head coaches, you followed Jim Harbaugh, who was with us yesterday from an RV park with his family, and now you're with us here today. You've done such a good job at Stanford. So the NCAA lifts this ban on campus activities for players June 1 through June 30. The first allowed step back to try to get your players towards a football season. There are a lot of questions, and I'll ask you those in a minute. But just directly to you, what maybe folks don't realize, it's got to be unique with Stanford. Your kids, your students are still in class. They don't wrap up until mid-June. So how does that impact you and your program directly?
Well, the NCAA, I think, is really what they're doing is saying, hey, it's up to each campus to say when they're ready to come back. We're 100% online right now at Stanford. Guys are knee-deep in their education. What each campus has to decide is who's coming back to campus, where they're going to stay. There's this huge thing that we're all kind of waiting for, which I think we're on the verge of, which is very rapid testing. I think that's part of bringing people back is being able to make sure that everybody's is healthy. And if they're not, you have to have a way to quarantine them to get them healthy and not infect your entire team. So I think that's a process that we're all talking about. Some places are ahead of others. Some conferences are ahead of other conferences as far as being able to either say everybody come back when you're ready or let's have a conference rule so that we can all be on the same page. So those are the next steps for everybody over the next couple of weeks.
What would you like to see the Pac-12 do?
Well, I think the Pac-12 has been pretty consistent. We would like uniformity, even whether it's all conferences or our conference, all kind of be ready to come back at the same time. If that doesn't happen, we all understand if somebody comes back a week ahead of somebody else, it won't be the biggest thing in the world or the worst thing in the world. So it's really incumbent upon each conference. And we had a great conference call yesterday in our working group about, you know, basically having some standards. You know, there has to be some minimums met in order to come back. It has to satisfy your state and local governments, has to satisfy your school and also the conference to make sure that you're not rushing back and you're not ready to handle the eventualities of what's going to happen because someone is going to be positive. Someone's going to test positive. And what are you going to do about that to protect the rest of your team, your staff, and your coaches?
And Stanford and University of Washington, because there were initial outbreaks in Seattle and Santa Clara County there near Palo Alto, you were among the first schools, not just football, but just schools to stop and say, hey, the rest of the semester or quarter in Stanford's case is going to finish online. So you've had really a great, strong head start in dealing with this with your team and with your campus. How about dealing with your players? How have they adapted to not just the virtual education part of it, but any sort of virtual football that you've tried to pull off with the guys?
Well, first of all, I have a lot of respect for Gavin Newsom, governor of California, a lot of respect for our administration at Stanford, our president and provost, really being on the forefront of saying, hey, let's make sure this doesn't affect everybody. Let's act first. Let's act quickly. Let's be efficient. So we transitioned very quickly to online. And initially on the football side, I told our coaches, leave the guys alone. This is a traumatic thing that's happening to everyone in America. So being pushed back home, starting classes online, getting your bearings. We had a lot of student athletes whose parents went through very difficult things, whether furloughed or temporary laid off. And there's a lot of things going on. Mm-hmm. So we allowed them to be people for a little bit, get your lives organized for a couple of weeks. And then we started coming back. We didn't have a lot of big meetings. What we had was really small meetings, individual meetings with the coaches and their position players, just so they could have a chance to have a dialogue and not just, hey, here's some more plays where football wasn't imminent at that time. There's no reason for us to really push these guys that hard. We wanted them to get settled, wanted them to feel supported. If guys needed something, we were able to help them out. So that was what our initial thought. And then as we got moving, then, of course, you know, those of us coaches over 30 years old figured out how to use this Zoom thing and really figured out how to change our backgrounds and show video. But we still kept those meetings short just so they could be conversational, they could be intimate, and guys can feel connected because that's one thing. You come to a university to feel connected to the university. You come to a team, a sports team, to feel like part of the team. And that was kind of taken away from these guys. So we try to make sure that that stayed a constant is our unity, our community. So the guys feel supported as we move on to the next stage.
It's weird. It happens so fast. I mean, I happened to be out on campus, and on Sunday, I came and watched your guys go through a little spring football workout before a basketball game, and then a week later, the students were heading back home, and school went online. So it just happened like this. And to sense the trauma for the kids, I think, is something that really connects with you as a coach and with your players. You know, Stanford's a different place. So is Notre Dame. So is Vandy. The people who are playing D1 sports, Duke, at a very high level, also trying to do the academic part. You know, David, when people use the term student-athlete, a lot of folks in the media, the debate show folks, they just go nuts and they think it's just the stupidest phrase out there. From your perspective, can you still have student athletes in 2020 and be able to do this given how high profile and how high profit sports has become?
That's a great question. And I think we could do probably a 2-hour segment just on that question. and no disrespect to anybody else that you mentioned, we don't use the term student athlete very often. We typically say scholar athletes. And you just look at the top of our roster over the last couple of years. Bryce Love graduated 2 quarters early as an All-American in football and a biology major because he wants to be a doctor. Christian McCaffrey was a 2-time academic All-American and the academic All-America of the year. So we believe we can do it at a high level. I think everyone can do it at a high level. I think there's a line between how much money is made and what we're actually trying to do, because I'm a Stanford alum. I'm a Stanford guy, and I think very methodically and systematically. And I like to come back and ask, what are we doing? Right? I say forget about the money and everybody gets all upset, but what are we actually doing? We're actually providing an opportunity for young people to get an education that some of them maybe wouldn't have gotten the education without the sports. So for us, it's about both. It's not just about the sports. It's not just about how much money is made by the universities, by the coaches, by the NCAA. I think the name, image, likeness thing is going in a good direction, and I have absolutely no problem with that. I think that's great. I think it's been coming, okay. And I think many of us have been preparing for it. But at the same time, that's really only going to benefit a certain portion of the student athletes. It's not going to benefit a lot of them in any great measure. What's really going to benefit these people is getting their education. So, yes, they should be student athletes. They should be scholar athletes. They should go to class. They should get a degree. Some of them are going to leave early if they got that opportunity, that earning potential. God bless them. Go get it. You know, go do it. Absolutely. But for the high percentage of them, they're going to make money off that education. They're going to make money off of their opportunities that come to them through their college experience.
95% of the conversation about the future of college sports is about 1% of the athletes, the ones who are at the elite level who can go pro early and do those things. And the rest we don't talk about. I'm glad you're able to give that some voice a little bit. But people have knocked on your door and they ask all the time, well, is David Shaw going to go to the NFL? Why do you still feel empowered, excited, energized by what happens in the college space, given all the different tentacles of college football that you just talked about?
I answer that question really with two things. Number one, my career was reverse of many coaches. 2 years out of college, I was coaching in the NFL. So I had 9 years of NFL experience. And so I know what that's about. It doesn't hold any, oh my gosh, I wonder what that feels like. I know what that feels like. I've been there. I've coached Hall of Fame players and great players and coached in everything but the Super Bowl. So I know what that feels like. That's number one. Number two for me is Stanford is a destination for me. Stanford's not a place you just kind of go through, do a good job, and jump out of here. That's not the way I see this job. You've been on campus multiple times. We've talked about your son's experience and people he's encountered with already. I love being at Stanford because I get the brightest guys. I get the most competitive guys on and off the field. I still tell people I write more recommendations than any football coach in America for graduate school, for job opportunities. I've helped guys get to the point where they're starting their own companies. That doesn't happen on any other campus other than ours. So I love the energy. I love the passion. Not to mention we're coming off a pretty doggone good decade and ready to start the next decade on a high note also.
And last season wasn't what you guys had built. What do you find as the energizing parts of the forecast for the 2020 season if it happens as planned?
You know, it's one of those silver lining opportunities where when you go back and you watch our film and, gosh, we were so close in so many games and some games we just didn't play as well, but you take out the bright spots and high percentage of those bright spots are guys that are coming back. Our quarterback, Davis Mills, threw for 500 yards against Washington State last year and really you saw him start to really grow towards the end of the year. We think he's going to be an outstanding quarterback, one of the top in college football. I think we've got two premier players that decided to come back. They didn't have to come back, but decided to come back. And Walker Little, our left tackle, has got a chance to be a superstar. high round draft pick Paulson Adebo at corner also. So we've got those high level players that decided to come back. We've got a lot of young guys that came in and played and did some really good things. And now with a year of experience, a year under their belts, coming back, being bigger, faster, stronger. I love where we are on our offensive line and our defensive line, the two premier places in college football. And I think we're going to have a lot of fun this year.
And on that style standpoint, one thing you do, tight ends, offensive linemen, it's kind of line up and play a physical brand of football, which is what's helped Stanford go in this direction here. Can that still have a championship place in the five wide, spread them out, let's throw the ball 75 times world that sometimes we dabble our foot in college football?
You know, I think things go in cycles. You've been around this game for a long time, and you see a lot of different things, a lot of trends happening. We're a prototypical West Coast offense, which for me means balance. We were imbalanced this past year. We had so many injuries on the offensive line. Couldn't run the ball that we were capable to. We're looking to get back to that balance, to be a physical running team up front with play action pass, as well as being able to adopt some things from other people. Now, I tell people all the time, you watch Chip Kelly and you watch us, and we look so different. But I think we've stolen more things from Chip Kelly than anybody else over the last decade. So you'll see some RPOs in our game. You'll see some no huddle. You'll see a lot of different things. So for us, it's about offensive versatility as well as balance. So I do believe you can be a physical running team. Gosh, for about 5 years, we were leading the nation in winning games by big margins. And a lot of it was throwing to score and running to win.
Throw to score, run to win. I like that. It's different. It's what you don't hear as much anymore, but I love it. Hey, great to catch up with you. I'm glad you and the family are best to all your folks, and we'll catch up with you out on the farm. Hopefully, fingers crossed, we see you in South Bend this fall. That'd be great.
Yeah, hopefully I'll see you there.
Thanks, David. David Shaw, coach of Stanford, terrific football coach. When we come back, a cooking segment. We're going to do it all here. Tom Colicchio from Bravo's Top Chef is going to join us. A guy who looks a little bit like one of the great baseball. Stay with us.
Pretty impressive Olympians out there.
You know, no big deal, just Miki Kaiseki for some of the best athletes in the world.
I know you guys like competition, so I got a question. Who has the most medals?
Yeah.
Come on. Oh, you guys know, come on.
No idea.
You have four. Yeah. Four. Yeah.
Is that what happens when a bunch of Olympians get together, though? Do you all say, like, so how many of you guys? When Tom's around, I guess.
It is Top Chef All-Stars LA. The episode airs tonight on Bravo. Somehow they ran out of people to find. I was asked to join the group, and Tom Colicchio, who is one of the faces of Top Chef over the years, joins us now. Tom, that was a really cool experience, and it was one of many in this Top Chef LA series. What was it like for you to be a part of that at the Coliseum in Los Angeles with those Olympians as well?
Yeah, that was really cool. My first Olympic experience was in Greece, and I remember watching women's volleyball, and I was blown away. I watched a lot of swimming, too. I was a swimmer when I was a kid, and so that was my experience. But walking into the stadium, and there's so much history there, it was blown away. It was so cool. Yeah.
It was crazy. 10 Eastern time, it airs tonight on Bravo, and it has a Tokyo theme, too. We were leading up to the Summer Olympics, obviously, which have been postponed for a year. What a fascinating season this is of Top Chef and Top Chef LA, because the challenges really bring together some Top Chef alums, if you will. So it was a pretty competitive group that was involved in this series and this season. What was that like for you in your role as the head judge?
Yeah, you know, in a way, it's a little harder because in a regular season, we don't know the chefs. And so, you know, when you don't know someone, it's a little easier to critique them. And so once you get to know people, it's a little harder. And so you kind of have to get over that. And because that's what they're there for, and that's what the audience wants to hear. And but it was, you know, it was a great experience. I mean, the food was just fantastic, which is always makes it easier. And, you know, shooting in L.A., it's just a great place to shoot. And we had you on. And so that was pretty awesome, too. You got to make your career on Top Chef. Yeah. Did I just Did I just spill the beans there? Because I wasn't supposed to do that?
No, you're not supposed to do that. Way, way, way at the bottom of the list was me. We have some great Olympians who were there in the Coliseum with us. Yes, yes, Tom. Hey, Tom, I'm just curious about what has happened with all the cooking shows here. Yeah, there we are with Ibtiaz Muhammad, Olympian, among others. Mm-hmm. Diana Taurasi at the table there. Yeah, you'll hear me talk like I know. Hey, there's one thing I can do with food, and that's eat it. I can't cook it, that's for sure. You know, on the cooking shows, Tom, it feels like the entire last 10, 15 years of the growth of this has turned cooking chefs, I should say, almost into artists and an appreciation for the craft. As somebody who's been a part of that, do you feel that everyone's perception of chefs has changed because of these reality TV shows?
Absolutely. You know, what I hear often from people is that they're shocked. They always ask, is this really happening in real time? And you saw it. It does. It happens in real time. When the food's ready, we eat it. And what they're really shocked is how quickly, especially creative people, how quickly you get a challenge, you have to think about something, and then immediately execute on that. And so for creative people, they're just floored by it. And so people, I think, have a much better appreciation for the work that a chef does. And also, I think, a better appreciation for the creative side of, you know, food. I mean, some restaurants you go to are pretty basic, and then some restaurants are really special. And I think people have got a better understanding of why that is, and a better sort of insight into how chefs think about food. So, yeah, I think it's definitely helped.
You have a couple of great restaurants, Gramercy Tavern in New York, and Kraft.
Well, Gramercy,
the restaurant business has been hit.
Yeah, Gramercy. I founded Gramercy, but I haven't been with them for a while. Yeah, but go ahead.
Exactly. And so many restaurants that I wanted to bring up that people know of have been shuttered and closed. This is a really difficult time for the restaurant industry as a whole. And you're one of the faces, voices, and people who is trying to help the folks in the restaurant industry who may need a lifeline here to stay on their feet. Can you explain what you've been trying to do and what the reception has been thus far?
Sure. I'm a co-founder of the Independent Restaurant Coalition, and the coalition came together very, very quickly, right around March 14th. Now, keep in mind, restaurants were all forced to close throughout the entire country. They were allowed to stay open for takeout, but since most of our businesses don't really do takeout, there was a big learning curve for that. And, you know, most of our restaurants at best were doing 20% of the business that we did before COVID hit. And so we've just been completely rocked. I mean, if you look at the unemployment numbers, the majority of those numbers come from restaurants. And so independent restaurants, we employ 11 million people. And then if you take into consideration all of the farmers and fishermen and cheesemakers and winemakers that we also indirectly employ, we're talking probably about 20 million people. And so we need a hand. We need help. And we were really, you know, glad to see that Congress passed the PPP bill, the CARES Act, which got us some money, but it really doesn't help because if the business is closed, it helps. If you're a small business and you're operating, PPP is great. If you're shut down, it's really not that helpful. And so we're asking for additional help from the government, not only to get us open, but to keep us open. Because my concern is that a lot of the small independent restaurants, we're going to open, but then because we're opening into a severely depressed market, we're not going to stay open. And so those unemployment numbers, they may start to get better because we'll open, but we're going to close again. And those restaurants won't come back. And right now the estimates are 80% of independent restaurants out there may not open.
That's a scary number. And that is a lot of the places where if you live in a town, travel one town over or travel across the country, those are a lot of the places that you know and have been many great dinners and good nights. So that we can all get out and back and support restaurants again.
Yeah. You point out something really good. It's not just about, you know, like well-known chefs like me. We're talking about the mom and pops. We're talking about the recent immigrant who was just naturalized, who pooled their money, and it's literally his mom and pop and the kids working in the restaurant. And those are the restaurants that really need to be saved as well. You know, the places that are a cornerstone of communities, the places where you celebrate birthdays and, you know, anniversaries, and the place that you want to go to feel normal on the other side of this, you know, once things open up where you actually can sit down and enjoy a meal. And we're a long ways from that. You know, we're still, you know, opening up with masks on, waiters in masks and bartenders in masks, and half our seats have to be removed from the restaurant. And so there's no way we're going to get back to normal for a very long time.
And sports fans who are watching, you know the restaurants that you go to or the bars you go to near the venues that you enjoy. Those are a big part of that. Before we leave, Tom, you had been confused in the past for Cal Ripken Jr. over the years. We got to put up that side-by-side shot of you. Have you ever had the chance to meet Cal?
No, I haven't. And you know what's even funnier? When we had hair, very little of it, people said the same things. We had the same haircut at one time when we had hair, which is very funny. But no, I've never met him, but I've heard that before.
We've got to get Cal. You got to get in touch with Cal, so at least we can connect you two for a good meal. Maybe he's the next guest you have next year on a Top Chef episode. It'd be a bigger name than you can find with me.
Yeah.
Exactly. Hey, Tom, it was a pleasure to be on the show with you, Padma, and everyone else. Look forward to the episode tonight. And more importantly, good luck with what your endeavor is to help the Independent Restaurant Coalition.
Thank you, Mike. It was a pleasure having you as well. Thank you.
My pleasure. Top Chef All-Stars LA tonight on Bravo at 10, 9 Central. When we come back, man who might win the Norris Trophy this year in the National Hockey League, top defenseman in the NHL, John Carlson from the Washington Capitals, will join us. Stanley Cup champ as well. He comes up after this.
Ask about John Carlson, just the season he's having.
Right John Norris.
Yeah.
Oshie, good hands. Backdoor look for Carlson. Off the deep. He scores! Carlson does it again!
That was filthy by John. What a deep...
goals, 60 assists, 75 points, career-best season in place for John Carlson, who for most is the favorite to win the Norris Trophy that goes annually to the best defenseman in the National Hockey League. And John Carlson joins us now. And I see an Arnold Palmer logo on that hat. Are you you got a, like every other hockey player, a terrific golf game?
I wouldn't say terrific. I think it's not too bad. This layoff hasn't been great. I haven't been able to get out much. So, you know, it's a work in progress for sure, like many other people, I'm sure.
What do you do best on the golf course?
I think I'm not great at anything, but I'm not bad at anything either. So I just kind of steady across the board. I can putt good one day. I can drive the ball good one day. It's just marrying all those things have seemed to eluded me over the years.
Welcome to the club. Is there one Washington Capital who you would take number one overall in your draft as a golf partner? Because of his quality of play, not because of having a good time, but the best stick on the Caps.
I think Backstrom is Oshie's right up there too. He's kind of you know, not played as much as he'd like, I'm sure, over the past couple of years. But Backstrom, his game's in good form right now.
How about you? Just the season comes to a halt here as you were just starting. What for teams like the Caps is that interesting stretch? Because I would guess, John, when you've won a cup 2 years before and you've been right in the middle of the mix so many years, with about a dozen games left in the regular season, that's kind of like, okay, it's getting real time. What was it like to have the plug pulled at that point in the regular season?
Yeah, it was tough to swallow. I think we were kind of maybe a day or two after basketball, so it wasn't like it blindsided us by any means. And it's certainly a weird time for everybody, regardless of what you do. And it's no different for us. I think there was you could see the light at the end of the tunnel getting into the best time of year. And to get shut down was it was tough, especially, you know, at that point in the season, you have a lot going through your mind, a lot of preparation going on to make sure you're in the best form you could be. And to have it cut off is not a great feeling.
How do you compare that time of the season, the beard growing, Stanley Cup playoff run time of the year, to the rest of the season? What's so different about it for you as an individual, maybe not on the ice, but just in your day-to-day life?
Yeah, I think you try to kind of attack the, you know, your whether you're training or watching video, whatever it is, I think you take it very serious all year long. I think it's just impossible to ramp up and have the – kind of jazz that goes on in the playoffs. I think it's impossible to play an 82 game season, with that same intensity all the time. And like anything, nothing gets done until you know, kind of your back's against the wall. So I think that's a big one for any hockey player. We know how much work goes in throughout those 82 games to kind of get yourself into top level form to, you know, get ready for the playoffs. And I think it would be a real long season, a lot of injuries if everyone played the same way all season long.
I mentioned the 2018 Stanley Cup, the victory over Vegas in five, and this is now year 11 for you. What's it like after all those years of playing and all those morning skates and all the pain you play through to know that your name is on the cup? Every time you see that cup, and every time somebody sees that cup, probably for as long as you're going to be around, John Carlson's name is on there. What does that feel like to finally have that happen?
Yeah, it's real special. I think, you know, we've had our struggles here in Washington getting over the hump and reaching that pinnacle. And I always said, all I want to do is win the Stanley Cup. That's all every kid dreams about. Any hockey player will tell you the same thing, I'm sure. But once you win it, you have that feeling, you have, you know, your name on the cup. It brings you into a different category, I would say. And just, you know, having my Stanley Cup day, learning from the Hockey Hall of Fame guys and hearing stories and seeing the names on there, it is, it's incredible, especially, you know, my father, my grandfather, and, you know, their favorite players that they watched as kids were on there. It's, you know, all encompassing, or, you know, hockey royalty.
You get chill just hearing you guys talk about that. It's so cool. You didn't have the same level of celebration that Ovi did with your day with the cup, right?
Yeah, not really. I think the captain gets it a couple more days than I would. And we had fun with it. We did a lot with it during the day, and we had a big blow up party at night. It was really special. And however long they give it to you is not long enough to really enjoy it like you would.
All right, now perhaps there's the chance to get it back again. What are your thoughts on what you're hearing, 2014 playoff, all these different scenarios? We don't know where it's going to end up. What do you think would be the best way if you can restart?
Yeah, I think that they're kind of jogging all their options right now and leaving the doors open for any potential scenario. I think 2014 sounds like a lot of teams to me, if I'm being honest, but you got to think about all phases of it, not just the playoffs and those games before the playoffs. How are they going to be played out? You got to make sure that there's some level playing field in terms of intensity, and you don't want some teams to be mailing it in when others are kind of prepping themselves for a playoff run. So 2014 sounds like a lot, but maybe due to logistics, that makes the most sense.
And as a player, as a prominent player in the league, what's your comfort level with, if there's a lot of testing, getting back on the ice and, you know, banging bodies with players and all the other stuff that comes with playing intense hockey?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me personally, I'm not worried about myself. I'm worried about that next step and who I would potentially be giving it to. I think I'm a healthy guy. I think I would fare okay against it. But you're worried. I got a family, I got kids. What is the repercussions of that? I think, personally, we can come back and start practicing in small groups, pretty soon. And I think that'll kind of help with, when training camps do open, when the testing does get where it needs to be able to kind of hit the ground running a little better. All the rinks around here are closed, so It's going to take a little while for players after a couple months off to really feel confident and comfortable on the ice again, I would say. But yeah, certainly if the testing's there, I'm all for it.
And real quick, I only have a few seconds. When's the last time you were on skates?
Yeah, that day that we found out we were playing, I think, Detroit that night. They came in for our morning meeting around 9 in the morning and said, hey, we're not going on the ice today. This morning, it's probably going to be canceled, but we don't know yet. And that was the last time. Okay.
Wow. So it's 9 weeks. Well, I hope you get back on skates. Caps fans, hope you don't have a lot of time this summer to work on your golf game and that you're trying to get your name back on the Stanley Cup. John, thanks. It's been a great season. I hope you get a chance to continue it, and hopefully we'll see you down the road.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
John Carlson from the Washington Capitals, terrific defenseman, best in the league this year, most folks think. When we come back, this would be Indy 500 weekend, our voice of the 500 and of the IndyCar series. Lee Diffie joins me to talk about it after this.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with a light from above, from the mountains to the prairies to the
So IndyCar Series will return on Saturday, June 6th, and this Sunday we'll have the Indy 500 back home again. We'll take you back to last year. Lee Diffie, our voice of IndyCar on NBC, who would have been calling the 500 this weekend, joins us here. That musical snippet, a couple of doctors from the Mayo Clinic who went viral with their version of John Lennon's legendary hit Imagine, and they come to the Brickyard and sing God Bless America, and man, it's just one of many emotional things. And Diff, that's one part of the Indy 500 that we'll recreate in some ways on the show on Sunday, but we all experience firsthand the patriotism and the meaning of Memorial Day is a significant part of the traditions of the Indy 500 that you got to experience from the booth last year.
Yeah, and it was so special, Mike, to have that honor and that privilege. And I kind of, when you say you feel for certain people, I feel for so many people on so many different levels, but particularly perhaps folks in the older generation who say, I've been going there for 45 years, I've been going there for 50 years, I've been going there for 30 years, and they're suddenly their world is rocked. This is just so unusual, but we'll press on, and we look forward not only to the special this weekend at 2 p.m. on NBC, but we look forward to August 23 for the 104th running of the Indy 500.
Yes, we relive last year and Lee's great call with Townsend Bell and Paul Tracy. That will be a big part of the show, but we also have freshened it up with interviews with Alexander Rossi, who finished runner-up to the winner Simon Pagenaud. They both join me at the Pagoda. I think you'll enjoy what they have to add about last year's show. And Lee, what you said, I went back to review the broadcast, and that stuck with me as I watched. The number of people who wanted to volunteer, welcome to Indy. I've been here for X number of consecutive years. There's such a connection with the sport and the Brickyard. For the drivers, what will it be like for them to get back there in August at a different time, but yet still have the 500? What do you think it'll be like?
Well, different for sure. They will get amped up like they always do, but particularly for the guys like Scott Dixon and Tony Kanaan and Sebastian Bourdais, Ryan Hunter-Reay, guys have been around for a long time. This is so unusual. You know, Townsend even said on this show yesterday, he's never been at home in May before. So he doesn't, it feels unusual to him. And, you know, in the latter stages of his career, he was just doing the Indy 500. That was the only race that he would do. So I think for all of them, they're all going through this very weird and different feeling. But come August, of course, it's going to be a little bit hotter in Indy, but they'll be up for it, Mike. They'll be ready.
Yeah. All right, we're a couple of weeks away from getting back to racing, the scheduled return of IndyCar in Texas, that first weekend in June. What have you observed from the way NASCAR has come back on Sunday and Wednesday that you now will shape your thoughts on what it will be like for IndyCar to come back here in a couple of weeks?
Well, I think NASCAR's done a very good job. And just for all of us, you don't have to be a motor racing fan, just a sports fan, just to see something happening again, it's been a breath of fresh air. So couldn't be more excited to look forward to June 6th. I think IndyCar will be really prepared, well prepared. I think there's still, you know, might be a little bit of schedule massaging. I'm not sure the schedule is completely set in stone just yet, but we've got a framework to work with, and there's a lot to look forward to. And I think the theme of double header weekends very much is the overarching theme for this year. The drivers, they've had to wait a long time to actually compete, but once we get our teeth into the meat of the season, boy, are they going to be busy.
the ones up on the screen there confirmed at the moment. And the 4th of July weekend will be a doubleheader with NASCAR at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So that'll be a lot of fun. Lee, the season hadn't started yet. You know, NASCAR season had started. You were getting ready for St. Petersburg and the season to start. What, in a general term, will be some of the differences this year, especially with the cars for IndyCar compared to what we'll go back and watch from 2019 when you watch on Sunday afternoon?
Well, the biggest thing, Mike, you know, visually and for the drivers experientially, is the aero screen, which was a safety implement that IndyCar had been working on with Red Bull Technologies, the Formula One team, and its partner, of course, Dallara, who build the chassis. A lot of work, a lot of very clever engineering gone into this, and it is, of course, under the umbrella of safety. They want to keep those drivers cocooned and safe if anything goes flying. And that's based on things that have happened historically in open wheel racing. So that will be the biggest thing to get used to. We got to see it in the virtual world in IndyCar's iRacing Challenge Series when we had that 6-week right. series. But the cars, I mean, sometimes it isn't so aesthetically pleasing. And then other times, depending on the color scheme of the car and the angle that you look at it, it looks great. They kind of look like fighter jets on the ground. So I think it will take fans some getting used to, but not too long.
They do. Rossi and Pagano in our show on Sunday take a lap at Indy in the 2020 version of the car. So for a lot of fans, it'll be the first time they get to see what it actually looks like. So that'll be fun. We had Tom Colicchio, the great chef, on earlier. You apparently have a lot of chef skills as well. I need an update, the man from all seasons for all sports from Brisbane, about the lamb lollipops that Lee Diffie cranks out.
The lamb lollipops, yeah. I do this at the end of every IndyCar season for the entire crew. So at our catering tent, at the food tent, the guys who do it for us are kind enough to set me up a big grill, and I cook it all for the team. But I'll do it here at home occasionally. My wife is pescatarian, so it's usually just myself and the boys, but she might steal one or two every now and then.
All right, well, when we are in the neighborhood, we will look for the Diffie lollipops, Lee's lollipops, coming perhaps to a restaurant near you. Diff, great catching up with you. We'll see you soon. Can't wait to get back to racing with you, bud.
We're meant to be having a nice bottle of red and a meal in Indy this weekend, so we'll have a rain check. We'll do it in August, all right?
Rain check on that partner for sure. Thanks, Lee. Lee Diffie, of course, calls rugby, our track and field as well, and our IndyCar. Ramona Shelburne and Scott Boras are the guests with Rich Eisen, the podcast or the YouTube channel if you missed anything. Tomorrow, Tim Layden, Justin Leonard, Daryl Strawberry, Simon Pagenaud, and Roger Bennett. Good show. See you then. Here's Rich.